to Thin Air Community Radio, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. The program is Praxis, live every Monday morning at 10. I'm your host, Taylor Weech. Today, there's a lot of ground to cover. Last Saturday, July 14th, I had the pleasure of going to the Washington Community Action Network's Summer Leadership Conference in Seattle, Washington. I was joined by 24 others from Spokane, which compared to last year, the last year's Summer Leadership Conference, the organization is based in Seattle, as many political and statewide organizations are. Last summer, three representatives from Spokane attended the Summer Leadership Conference. This year, 25 did. So that's over an 800% increase. A lot of that can be attributed to the great Spokane organizing team that they've brought over. They've led a lot of direct action here in town, workshops and things like that. And a quick shout out to Amanda Hunt, who I interviewed back in April. She received the Rising Sun in the East Award from Washington Community Action Network. I think I got that name right. Basically in Eastern Washington, talking about a great organizer from over here who brings our needs and values over to the broader organization. So basically, for those who don't know, Washington Community Action Network is a big organization based in Seattle, as I said, and they work on a number of issues from economic justice to social justice, healthcare. They've been really big on the healthcare reform issue this last year with making sure the Affordable Care Act was passed and then defending it during the Supreme Court challenge, defending, countersuing against our Attorney General Rob McKenna when he sued to overturn the Affordable Care Act and many other actions. So this conference is an annual event that they hold during which all of their membership can get together, take workshops, have discussions, listen to panels, and sort of, I think, mostly to celebrate what's happened throughout the year and get geared up for more work in the future and bring other people on board. So it was really interesting for me to go, being not really an active member of the organization and having gone to a couple events, but not very many, sort of coming in as an outsider to do interviews, observe, and just see what it's all about. So the main things, I have 8 hours or so of audio from this event. There were hour-long workshop sessions, and I decided to be strategic and physically go to one session while leaving a recorder playing in another session so I could be in two places at once. So I later reviewed all of my notes and that audio, came up with a lot of content. So I decided that I would focus today on a couple different areas, which are economic reform. There were some interesting ideas presented for revenue generation in the state of Washington. We have a huge budget gap. Which whether or not, you know, if you're like me, you don't really put much stock in the current political or economic structure that we have now. But the fact is, it's what we have now. And in some ways, it's necessary to work within it to make it work better while you're in the process of building something new. So that's something that I kind of worked on a lot this last weekend over there, because I'm usually pretty hesitant to patch the things up that aren't working and would prefer to destroy them completely and start over. So this was a good exercise for me in kind of seeing, getting to know the people who do that work, kind of the intervention work, the emergency room services of state politics. So we're going to talk about economic stuff. And also a ton of the footage I have is on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you'd like to call it. And I think there's a lot of misconception about the law and about what the effects are going to be. And there was a great workshop called Nuts and Bolts of Healthcare Reform that offered just that. I'm going to play a lot of that for you. Then at the end, we have a little bit of election stuff and things like that. So it's a mixed bag. It's a busy time. I'm hoping I can get through all of it in 1 hour. And thanks to everyone who helped put together the Summer Leadership Conference, Rachel DeCruz, Mariah McKay, Amanda Hunt, organizing here, bringing us all over in carpool caravan mode. So it was really great. So I think we're going to start with economics. As I think most people realize at this point, the economic structure we have is not working for most people, or really for almost anyone at all. And there was a workshop put on by Rachel DeCruz, who's the outreach manager for communications at Washington Community Action Network, Janet Boggs, who's a longtime member of Community Action Network, and Ben Second, who's the outreach manager at the Washington State Budget and Policy Center, which is a nonpartisan center that analyzes the budget and works on budget and policy issues and communications to the people so that they can understand what's going on in Olympia. So the three of them put on a workshop called The 1% and the Rest of Us. That's about a capital gains tax as a revenue option in Washington. That's something that we haven't ever had in Washington before. And they'll explain more what a capital gains tax is and how it differs from an income tax and what it might be able to do for our state. I really like it. I like this presentation because it's specific. It's really hard for me to listen to these really vague, we need more revenue. We need more revenue. We need it. Our programs are suffering. And hearing that over and over again, never really hearing any specific ideas. So this is the opposite, where they gave a very specific plan saying this is exactly what we'd like to do. These are the exact results we'd see from it. So I will play that in just a moment. The clip that I'm going to play, I think, is almost entirely Ben Second, who's the man from Budget and Policy Center, just because he had a lot of the content that I wanted to use. And a quick fact, there are, let's see, 9 states that do not have capital gains tax. They're also the states that do not have a state income tax. Those are Alaska, Florida, Nevada, New Hampshire, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming. So, without further ado, we can hear more about capital gains tax in Washington and what it might do for folks.
First, we have shared values as Washingtonians, and those values are at stake. They're threatened right now. They're on the line right now. The Great Recession hit, and our state has been going through really deep crisis in terms of our budget, and that has disproportionately impacted low-income communities, women, communities of color. I don't have immigrant communities up there, but that's certainly another community that's been disproportionately impacted. The third thing I want to touch on today is Washington's tax system, which is a broken tax system that doesn't meet our needs as a state, and it's unfair. And then finally, I'm going to try to leave us with a bit of a positive note on a solution that can help us take a step in the right direction, and that's passing a capital gains tax in the state. So this is where our money goes in the state budget. This was the 2011-13 budget. You can see we're spending a lot of money on core education and healthcare services, and then a little bit on providing economic security for families, and then protecting our communities. But here's the problem. There's a gap between the needs of the state and the state's ability to meet those needs. So our population's growing, healthcare costs go up, there's more demand for the education services in the state. The need is going up. The state's ability to meet that need is going down. So when you hear terms like budget deficit or budget gap or budget hole, that's really what we're talking about. There's this fundamental gap between our needs as a state and the state's ability to meet those needs. Take healthcare, for example. Since the recession started in 2009, there's been a huge drop in employer-sponsored health coverage. Almost 240,000 people in the state have lost their employer-sponsored health coverage. Now, that could be because they've lost their job outright and no longer get coverage, or because some companies will say, look, the recession's hitting us hard, we can no longer provide health care either to you or to your spouse and your dependent children. So at that point is when you'd like the public to be able to step in and provide that kind of insurance. And you can see that public insurance through Medicaid has tried to do that, but you can see that there's a gap there between people that lost it and people that were able to get coverage. So when we're talking about the gap, it's not just a number. It's people losing health insurance. There's a need, and the state's not able to meet that need. And we've had a choice. We could have raised taxes. We could have cut corporate tax loopholes, raised taxes on the wealthy, to help fill that gap a little bit. But you'll see here that since 2009, what have we done? We've cut over $10 billion from core education and healthcare services, and we've only increased taxes by about $600 million. So the balance is all out of whack. It hasn't been balanced at all. It's been almost entirely an all-cuts approach. And that has an impact. you see that 85% of the budget cuts that we've seen have gone to healthcare and education programs. I want to switch gears just a little bit. We're talking about the impact of the budget cuts, and certainly the Great Recession has sort of come in and made things a lot worse in our state. But fundamentally, our revenue system is broken, and it doesn't meet our needs, and it's not a fair system. So first, just talking briefly about how it doesn't meet our needs. The main reason is because we rely too heavily on the sales tax. In 1979, say I'm the average income earner in the state, about two-thirds of my income would have gone to things that the sales tax would have captured. Fast forward to today, and only about a third of that is captured by the sales tax. It's as our economy has shifted to more of a service economy, we're spending, consumers are spending differently, and the state is taking in a lot less sales tax. You hit the Great Recession, people lose their jobs, people lose their income, they're not spending as much money, the state is bringing in way less. So it's just, we rely way too heavily on the sales tax, especially in hard times like this. It's just not a stable source to be able to fund the education and healthcare programs that we care about. And this is always the one that makes me the most angry. We have the most unfair tax system in the country. If you're a corporate CEO, and we have a lot of those in this region, and you make $1 million, $2 million, $3 million dollars a year, you're going to pay less than 3% of your annual income in state and local taxes. If you're a janitor or a food service worker, somebody who makes closer to minimum wage, you pay 17% of your income in state and local taxes. So it's a tax structure that's just completely upside down. It's the most unfair in the entire country. All right, so let's attempt to end on a somewhat positive note. I want to talk about something that the state could do to help put us on a much better track and solve a couple of the core problems that we've talked about, and that's to enact a capital gains tax. So just a quick note on the capital gains tax. What it does is it taxes an asset once you make a profit on it, but it's only certain kinds of assets. It's stocks, it's bonds, it's things like when you sell a vacation home. So a second or third home that you have, and you sell that and you make a profit on it, then you would pay the capital gains tax. But it does three important things. It does a great job in helping us meet our needs. It would raise up to $700 million every year that the state can invest in making college more affordable or providing basic health slots to people that were kicked off the program or reducing class sizes. You know, I mean, we could think of a number of good ways to use $700 million every year. The nice thing about it is it's trying to rebalance our unfair tax structure in that it's really asking the top 1% to pay their fair share. Overwhelmingly, the tax would be paid by people who are millionaires, who make a ton of money in the stock market every year. People like a presidential candidate named Mitt Romney. It also puts us in a lot better position to weather the kind of economic downturn that we're seeing right now. If we had had a capital gains tax in place, we wouldn't be so heavily reliant on the sales tax, and it would help us weather the deep impacts of the Great Recession. Again, if you remember the slide I showed two slides ago where the poorest people in the state are paying 17% and the top 1% are paying 3%, this is a complete reverse. You can see here that overwhelmingly people that are making more than $1 million pay all of the capital gains tax. So it really is targeted at people that are making a ton of money that aren't paying their fair share in the state here. So I just want to be clear, this is not an income tax. You would not see one penny come out of your paycheck ever. This is not something that applies to ordinary home sales. So if you bought a home, you've been living in it for 20 years, it's your primary residence, you sell it, you make profit off it, do not pay a penny in capital gains tax. And importantly, it doesn't touch retirement savings or retirement income. So if you're set up to get Social Security or you have a 401k or an IRA plan, no retirement plan or retirement income is touched by the capital gains tax. This is really targeting people that are getting a large sum of income every year through the stock market and through, you know, secondary vacation homes and things like that, investments that are not paying their fair share into the system.
Do you have any numbers on that in like a corporate sense? I know small business. I know a lot of people who run small businesses here, and the taxes seem like pretty heavy on them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Do you have any numbers on the difference between what small businesses are paying as to corporations?
I don't. Not to get super into the weeds on it, but Washington has a really weird way of doing business taxes.
Yeah.
A lot of states have a corporate tax that taxes profits. So if a business is very profitable, they pay taxes on that. In Washington, you pay taxes on all of your gross receipts. So everything that comes in, you could have a net loss in a year as a business in Washington State that is still owed.
How long have we been waiting for trickle-down to work?
Trickle-down to work, but we got all the debt. The debt trickled down.
So that was mostly Ben Second was the voice you were hearing there from the Washington State Budget and Policy Center. At the end, there were a couple questions from participants in that workshop. The very end there was, I cut out the explosion of laughter after that, but I liked her comment that the debt trickled down and the trickle down did work in that sense. His last point that he was making about small businesses and their tax burden, I think is really valid, and it's something that doesn't get intelligently discussed very often because so much of the rhetoric around taxes is oversimplified in our culture. You either hate all taxes indiscriminately or just think we need more of them really vaguely. And I really liked that we got some nuance in that discussion because it's really important. I talked to friends of mine who are maybe more on the so-called conservative end of the spectrum, but it's because they're small business owners and they understand the way that taxation affects what they're able to do with their livelihood, what they're not able to do, and how much they can really contribute. Like he said, in our current system, your business can have a net loss and you still owe a pretty sizable tax burden at the end of the year. So I thought that was a really good workshop. It was really interesting. My only real qualm with it was that Ben uses the term Great Recession really repetitively. And I just don't like that term in general because I think it implies that what we're going through economically right now is something that we're going to bounce back from. I don't believe that that's true. I think what we're seeing is, you know, middle stages of the complete collapse of a failed economic system that's just not going to work. The model just doesn't work. I don't think there's really a way to revive it. So I think calling what is happening right now a recession is kind of a false way to characterize it. Other than that, though, I thought it was great information. Really concise and good. So thank you, Washington Community Action Network, for putting that that presentation workshop together. There were a lot of other good questions and answers. This footage was all really hard to edit down because there were so many thoughtful people there asking good questions and, you know, making good points. And it took me a very long time to prune down to what we have now. So I may use more of this footage in the future on future shows. And if you'd like more of it, what I could do is post entire chunks unedited on my podcast page at kyrs.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis Monday morning, and I'm doing a quick recap of the Washington Community Action Summer Leadership Conference that took place on July 14th over in Seattle. While my trusty audio recorder was recording that workshop, I was next door in another room in a workshop presented by the keynote speaker of this conference, Richard Kirsch. He's a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, as in Franklin and Eleanor, and he's a fellow at the Rockefeller Institute. And he just wrote a book, he published it in February, called Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. The workshop of his that I went to was called, let's find the exact title so I don't butcher it, Building a Progressive Narrative for a 99% Economy. And the description was, for 30 years, the 1% have gotten richer at the expense of the 99%. In order to organize and mobilize to right this economic injustice, people need to understand the crisis, what went wrong, and who's responsible. In this workshop, Richard Kirsch will present a narrative that organizers and leaders can use to tell the story of the crisis and our vision of how to build a 99% economy. I'll be honest, the reason I went to this workshop is because I was skeptical whether or not it would be something that was useful for me. Something that's frustrating to me, I understand the strategic value for organizations of having a unified story that they use. I understand the value for political parties in that, but it's hard for me personally to get behind, kind of, we're all going to agree on the talking points and we're all going to use them, because I think it takes a lot of the pluralism and diversity out of movements and out of the way we communicate about them. So this workshop was interesting, though, because of the other people who were in it and what they ended up saying. So basically what he shared is kind of this model for telling any story and getting people more on your side with your story. So he talks about the five pillars of that, where you need to, he talked about, the example he gave was on the economy and how to build a so-called 99% economy that works for more people. So the first pillar was, what's the economic problem? Why isn't it working? And then he'd move to, this is what a successful economy would look like and what makes it work. The third is, what is the role of government in this? How do we get moving forward again together? And then the fourth is, what's the political problem? What do we have to do to get people in agreement that this is what we need to work on? And then he finishes with a call to action. That's kind of the point of telling this story, is to get people to do something, something specific. So I thought the way he told the story was effective, and I know that I've heard it before. So it's been used already. It's been kind of the agreed upon narrative. So this is just a quick sum up of what he said. And then we went on to write our own stories like this, our own narratives for an issue of our choice. So basically, this was prepared for the Progressive Economic Narrative Group by the USA Action Education Fund, on which Richard Kirsch is a leader. So why isn't the economy working? For the past 30 years, the rich got richer while the middle class and working families got squeezed and crushed. Corporations pushed up profits by pushing down wages and benefits and shipping our jobs overseas. As the 1% grabbed more and more, the 99% got squeezed, saved less, and borrowed more, particularly from their houses. When the housing bubble burst, the government bailed out Wall Street but let homeowners go underwater, drowning the economy. How do we get our economy moving forward again? By making our economy work for the 99%. The American middle class is the engine of the economy. We all do better when we all do better. A strong middle class, the engine of the economy, is built by the decisions we make together. It does not happen on accident. What do we, the 99%, have to do together for our country? We need to make our democracy work for us, the 99%. We're not broke, we've been robbed by the Wall Street speculators who wrecked our economy and got bailed out, by the corporate lobbyists who bought our democracy out from under us, by the super rich who paid politicians to cut their tax rates in half while their incomes went up 500%. We know the problem. Our democracy has been robbed by the 1%. It's up to us to organize together in our communities across the country to make our democracy and our government work for the 99%. We are fighting for an America that works for everyone, with liberty and justice for all, including good jobs for everyone in America, making Wall Street, corporate America, and the super rich pay, investing in our families, ending corporate control of our democracy, and putting our democracy back in the hands of the 99%. The choice is clear. We stand with the 99%. The working families and the small businesses that create two-thirds of American jobs. They stand with the 1%, the Wall Street speculators and CEOs who cut our wages, crashed our economy, and shipped our jobs overseas. The question we have to ask every member of Congress is, which side are you on? So, whew, that was a long story, but you can see how it is an effective way to summarize your points, this kind of model for building a narrative that Richard Kirsch presents. That was directly quoted from the sheet that he gave as an example. The problem that I had with it that I brought up, I wish I had it recorded because I'd like to remember exactly what his response to me was. But in his presentation and in that narrative, it only talks about America and us and how we need to make the economy work for us. The problem that I see with that is that our economy, our whole model of growth capitalism, is based on exploiting the resources of other places around the world, be it cheap labor, natural resources, fossil fuels, etc. And we usually tend to use violent means to acquire those resources. So I brought that up and wanted to include that as part of a vision for a just economy. I think it, you know, obviously involves the planet and the other people on it who aren't Americans. He didn't really address that, and I understand because it wasn't the point of what he was doing. But then we got a chance to get in groups of our own choosing and kind of practice writing a story like this for that. So it was kind of a strange task, and it was interesting. I wish I had more time to cover how it ended up working. But so There were two healthcare groups, since that was the main thrust of this whole conference, a group working on the environment, and I ended up, imagine that, in kind of the black sheep group of folks who wanted to talk about other things entirely. I wanted to be able to tell the story of how to completely replace all of our systems, which is kind of vast, and I don't know how you can tell that in a quick story, so I thought it'd be a good challenge. There were some other people who wanted to talk about moving toward a total economic overhaul that's not based on incorporated capitalism. So we kind of got lumped together, and it was me and I think probably the four oldest men in the room. So it was kind of a strange mix, but it was very interesting. We had a good discussion, and we ended up saying that the problem, to use his model, the problem is the structure itself of our form of capitalism, with concentrated ownership and labor and management pushing up into the enrichment of that ownership class. A successful economy would be equitable, cooperative, and value-based with a fair tax code. True value-based, not in harmony with a monetary policy that's also fixed by some of the same agencies that are profiting from our current form of capitalism. The role of government would be to provide basic protective services for that our more cooperative model can work. The political problem is the concentration of power by that incorporated wealth that we currently have. And we didn't get far enough to have a call to action other than to talk about this more. So you see pretty quickly that with a complex issue such as that, this model becomes really hard. And I guess, while I thought it was an interesting exercise, I already kind of covered this, but I just disagree with the idea of having one narrative. I get why it's politically strategic, but I think it's more valuable to have everyone in the conversation and really work toward discussion rather than presentation of a narrative. So it was a really interesting workshop. He was an interesting guy, and it was really good. The keynote, the audio quality wasn't very good, and he was mostly sharing stories from his book that were about why we need the Affordable Care Act. It was kind of, they were very emotionally charged stories, personal to a lot of the people that were there. So it's hard to talk about the nuts and bolts, which is the title of the workshop I'm going to use to talk about the Affordable Care Act, through such an emotional lens. And that's what's difficult about healthcare reform. This is an issue that obviously, you know, people die because of not having adequate health coverage. So it's going to be an emotionally charged topic. It's going to be sad, and it's frustrating because it seems sometimes that if you are finding fault with the law itself, folks have a tendency to sometimes put you in a camp that just doesn't care about saving people's lives, and there's this oversimplification. I was happy to see that didn't happen at this conference to me, because I'm not a very strong proponent of the Affordable Care Act. I think it does some good things, which I'm about to share, but I think the way that it does them, it just doesn't go far enough. So we'll talk about that. And I have highlights from the workshop at the leadership conference, which was called Nuts and Bolts of Healthcare Reform. Nice and descriptive. And it was presented by Shomaine Evans, who's the first person you'll hear talking in this clip. Rachel DeCruz, who was also in the first one I played. She's the outreach manager for Community Action Network Washington. And Dina Knudsen, who is the chair of the board of Washington CAN. And they'll both be talking in that order, Rachel and then Dina, toward the end of this clip. So I will play that right now. And it just really, I think it's really important for people to understand what the Affordable Care Act is all about before they can criticize or be for it. So this gives you a ton of information in a short amount of time with what it actually does, what it does do, and what it doesn't do.
I'm going to introduce the problem in basically first slide. Insurance companies cannot place lifetime limits on the amount of coverage they provide, or just drop you from coverage if you're sick. Racial disparities and lack of access, particularly in poor people of color community, like not having access to healthy food, not having access to green areas or safe parks, was one of the issues I've dealt with growing up. And I'll share that later about where I come from. Liquor stores, no hospitals, only clinics, no gyms. This impacts people's ways to stay healthy and prevent sickness. This image, particularly right here, is a food desert. How many people know about food deserts? Well, where I live at, I live in West Oakland, Oakland, California. Where I live at, we have 56 liquor stores and not one grocery store. And on top of that, we have a credit union but no bank. We have a hospital that's only like a clinic. But we have a police station with over 800 police officers. So that right there, me seeing the contradiction between the racial disparity, the health disparity, the environmental situations, and how it impacted us to prevent our sickness really, really, really impacted me as a youth. Previously, new insurance plans and Medicare were not required to offer free preventive health care. In insurance plans, Medicare was not teaching prevention, how to have balanced diet, manage stress, and stress reduction. Also, the importance of being active and just being happy. Prevention care was not encouraged because it cut down profit for insurance companies. Insurance companies were banking on people remaining sick and unhealthy.
Everyday people don't understand the law, and the Republicans have been extremely good at spreading lies, right?
Scaring people.
Yeah, exactly, right? Scaring people that the government is going to come into their home and like take them out of their beds and then, you know, it's all over. It's not what's happening. Healthcare reform is a good thing. It expands access and it makes care more affordable. But that's a really good point. I will keep that in mind for the next 7 days.
Thank you.
But so in terms of benefits that are already in place, small businesses are receiving tax credits to help them pay for the cost of insuring their employees. The businesses that qualify are small businesses with full-time employees that are 25 or less full-time employees and people who are making a salary of under $50,000. No more lifetime limits on coverage, right? So in the game, there was somebody who had cancer. When you have an illness that or a chronic condition that takes a lot of care, what used to happen is you would hit a cap, right? All of a sudden, your insurance company wouldn't pay anymore, and you would have to pay out of pocket for these really expensive, whatever they need to be, medical appointments, surgeries, anything like that. And insurance companies also used to be able to just drop your coverage when you got sick, right? They're like, too much of a risk. I don't want to deal with it. You're off. That can no longer happen. Young adults up to 26 can now stay on their parents' plans. We all know how scary it is to graduate from college and not know what's happening, especially in this economy. This gives people a little bit more time to get on their feet so that once, hopefully when they turn 26, they're fully employed and they've got health insurance and they don't have to worry about things quite as much. Children with pre-existing conditions can no longer be denied coverage at all, right? In the past, if you had a pre-existing condition as a child, you could be denied coverage no matter how young you were. And what's in place for adults now who have pre-existing conditions is something called a pre-existing condition insurance plan. So this is for folks who have actually explicitly been denied coverage because of a pre-existing condition. There's now this pre-existing condition insurance plan where they can get coverage to meet their needs and to manage their health.
Is that in place now?
That is in place now. And in 2014, the way it's going to work is just no insurance companies will be able to deny coverage based on a pre-existing condition. That's awesome. Seniors on Medicare are saving money on prescription drugs. The way it used to work is there would be something called the donut hole. Does anyone know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, you would hit a certain level of money on your prescription drugs, and then you would have to pay out of pocket to cover another gap, and then at a certain point, insurance used to kick in again. But so what the Affordable Care Act is doing is it's minimizing that gap. Right now, it's giving people rebates on their prescription drugs, and then in 2014, I believe the donut hole will begin shrinking until it completely closes, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. We also have free preventive care on all new insurance plans of Medicare, so you know something like a flu shot, you've got to go get your annual mammogram, or however often you get those. Anything to help with preventive care is now free, no co-pays, no out-of-pocket costs to consumers. And also, one of my favorite things, the 80-20 rule, this is what Shomaine mentioned earlier, 80% of your premiums need to go into your care. right? So they can't go to like other things like lobbying, like overhead, like administrative costs, or any kind of CEO profits. And what that just really helps to ensure that we have transparency and accountability for the insurance companies, right? We're in a position now where we're able to hold them accountable. If you didn't use this much amount of my money on my health care, you get that money back in a rebate check. We are also going to have this new thing called a health insurance exchange, which I know has been extremely hard. It's been hard for me to wrap my head around it. It's a little bit confusing. But the way that I like to explain it is it's like Travelocity, except for healthcare insurance, right? So you now have a one-stop shop where you can go to shop for different health insurance plans. And the way it works, in order to make coverage affordable, they are going to be offering premium assistance on a sliding scale, right? So it's going to be based on your income. So there's going to be a set amount of health insurance plans that are in this exchange that are regulated by the federal government, meaning that we have plans that are comprehensive and that offer the care that we need, that offer good quality care. Right, and members of Congress are also going to be getting their insurance through the health insurance exchanges.
So that's
exciting. But it's also important to note that people who have coverage now through their employer, you are only going to be going to the health insurance exchange if you're either uninsured right now or you move on with jobs and you need health insurance at whatever point. People who are currently enrolled in health insurance plans right now aren't going to have to worry about this. And also, I mean, the main thing, the prevention piece is really important too, right? Because as we are starting to be able to get access free preventive care, more people are going to be going to the doctor on a regular basis, right? So it's going to help us cut down on our healthcare costs in the long run, and it's just going to ensure that we're healthier because we detect things earlier. A nonpartisan analysis from the Congressional Budget Office has said that healthcare reform will produce $143 billion in net budgetary savings over the period from 2010 to 2019.
That's great.
So it's $143 billion in savings over the 2010 to 2019 period. So when people tell you that healthcare reform is going to raise the deficit, they are wrong. Unless they want to go have a fight with the Congressional Budget Office, they are wrong. It will actually reduce the deficit over time. And it does that by cracking down on fraud, waste, and abuse in Medicare.
So the thing is, it sounds great. Problem is, it's going to be our legislators who get to decide whether we get the basic health option. So the next step, obviously, is to make sure that those legislators understand how important it is to us. And so it's going to take us going in and actually lobbying them and talking to them and educating our neighbors and getting them to come out and talk to their legislators and making sure that the basic health option becomes a priority for our legislature. And so that is one of the pieces that we're looking as next steps for Washington Can, is to take our grassroots and get out there and make a difference. Okay, the next piece that is, of course, what some people have noticed, there's some things that aren't covered. Dental. Anybody who's had had a tooth go bad or had abscess can tell you that is really something that you need taking care of. And it's not covered under medical. Neither is vision. I don't know about anybody else, but I can't go anywhere without my glasses. And to me, it's an essential service. Obviously, we have to expand the idea of what should be covered. Dental and vision are both things that are essential to people and need to be covered under health care. The insurance companies are going to be thinking along the lines of, okay, now we've got this whole act, now let's see how much better we can make it for ourselves. And the only people who are going to be watching are going to be people like us. So we're going to have to hold them accountable. Now, our insurance commissioner has already got implementing a new law that would allow him to look at surpluses. The insurance companies have, they always say they have to have these huge surpluses. He can look at the surplus before they get a tax, a rate hike. Okay, hold them a little more accountable. We're all going to be on board with that. We want our insurance commissioner to be really, really strong, be able to hold them accountable. And we're also going to have to make sure that whoever is our insurance commissioner is accountable to us. And we're going to have to make sure then we get out there and do that direct action and actually get down in those insurance companies' doors, like Primera and some of the others, and make them sure, let them know, we're there. We're watching you. You step out of line, we're going to hold you back. Take you back to where you belong. And we need to make sure the legislators understand they're beholden to us, not the insurance.
So that was, most recently, Dina Knudsen, the chair of the board of Washington Community Action Network. She is pretty fierce. Every time I've seen her speak, she's been pointing the finger and raising a ruckus. So that's a good quality in an organizer. So something I want to go back and touch on, she talked about the basic health option, but I kind of dumped you into the middle of the part of that conversation that they were having. Just to be clear, so Rachel DeCruz was explaining the role of the exchange, which I really like her metaphor of being like Travelocity or Kayak, something that basically it'll put all of the insurance companies side by side so you can compare directly what the differences are when you're shopping for private insurance, as you're now required to hold insurance through the ACA. And in some places, so there's been conversation about whether or not there's a public option, so an option from the state. Like in Washington State, we have Washington Basic Health, which has been a successful program. It's just not big enough. It can't accommodate all of the adults who need it right now. So that would be held up side by side by side in the spirit of competition, which is, we're told constantly, an all-American value. It would be next to the private insurers and kind of set a standard for them to be forced to compete with. I like that idea. I better like the idea of just having single payer, one universal healthcare system like Canada, like so many other industrialized nations have. But because we have such a powerful, powerful voice from insurance companies that are for profit, not for quality service, if you just think about it on a very basic level, their interest is in profit. There is no profit in having healthy people. So why would those be the people that we trust to take care of our health coverage? I do not know. So also going back, the beginning of that clip, if you missed it, I'm sorry, you should definitely check it out on the podcast on KYRS.org. Shomaine Evans, he's an organizer for tenant rights and against gentrification and food deserts in West Oakland. And he was talking about what are often called the social determinants of health. So what are the things about the place you live, the food you have access to, that determine whether or not you're going to be a healthy person? The Spokane Regional Health District just did a study on just this in Spokane and looked really neighborhood by neighborhood. It's a fascinating study. It shows there's a 17-year life expectancy gap between the most wealthy and least wealthy neighborhoods in Spokane. A lot of it is stuff that might seem obvious, especially to people like social workers who live or who are immersed in this all the time. People who are poorer are more likely to smoke cigarettes and more likely to have poor health. Yeah, we can look at that and observe it, but now there's data that really shows all of it. And that's key to organizations that are trying to affect change in areas like this. So I really liked this workshop because at the beginning, I mean, like I already said, I'm not really a proponent of the Affordable Care Act. I think it's important that these things get done, but I think it's important that more than that get done. So I was really reassured. I think some Washington CAN people who I'm friends with can attest to me being kind of surly about, claiming this as a victory and things like that. But I do definitely see the value in filling some of these gaps now. And it's reassuring to me to see that Washington CAN and so many other organizations are saying, and we're not done yet, we need to move toward having a national health plan. And I was lucky enough to run into Kathleen Randall, who is a member of, I don't remember what her role is, but she's a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. And I got to sit aside with her for a minute. Part of this interview is rather loud in the background. We were in a middle school, Aki Kurosu Middle School, which is a great, oh my gosh, it was a really cool middle school. Really cool murals on the campus. There was a montage in the girls' bathroom. This is a segue, but oh well, a tangent. There was a poster with clippings from magazines that were saying, you know, this isn't real, they photoshopped this, you're beautiful the way you are. And I just think those should be in every middle school bathroom on earth. So yay, Aki Kurosu Middle School in Seattle. Really awesome campus. Anyway, so you'll hear some background noise there, but this is Kathleen Randall, talking about Physicians for a National Health Program and what their work is and what she hopes to see the next steps as going forward.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Randall, and I'm a board member of Physicians for a National Health Program. I'm a member of the League of Women Voters, and I work at Overlake Hospital. Ready?
All right, and we were in a workshop together, and you mentioned that you've been in the health industry for...
Over 40 years.
Over 40 years, and you have a button on right now that says healthcare is a human right.
Yes.
What's your position on the ACA? What's your opinion?
Well, I am not a terrifically strong advocate of this legislation. My preference would have been to see the idea of a human right means that this is something that people have a right to. And if they have a right to it, then the government has a responsibility to meet that need. It's a universal need. They required it after World War II for 1948 for the European countries and other Asian countries who were affected by World War II. And then the United States didn't sign on to it until really late. So I think that the United States is way behind the eight ball. Had we signed on to the Universal Bill of Rights, then we would have had universal health care by now. We would probably not have people sleeping under bridges and in doorways and on our streets. People would find food. It would be provided if they were unable to find food, and that we would have had a much higher commitment to jobs. Maybe our jobs might not have paid quite so much, but people would be working and families would be intact. So I think that our government has kind of let us down a little bit by failing to address that. And one of the things I would have wanted to see with healthcare as a human right is that we start with healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have generated jobs. It would have given small business as well as large business a more competitive edge in the world market. I think that we would have had less competition and more a sense of community, security, and safety. You'd have people in less vulnerable circumstances, and they would not have been kind of positioned to have to move to such extreme measures to get their needs met. So we would have far less crime.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I think our government has let us down in that respect. So,
what does your group, Physicians for a National Health Plan, correct?
Health Program.
Health Program.
Yes.
What do you advocate as next steps from the ACA?
We're actually, we do think that we are trying to support the legislation as it is right now because we realize it will mean a terrific advantage for many people. And there are some very good aspects to it. Believe me, I really approve of those. We just don't ever see that really leading to a national health plan at this time, and that's what we really think we need. We'll still have 20 to 30 million people without health care.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge amount of people across the country.
Mm-hmm.
We'll still have a number of people who will be dying every year. Right now we have 45,000 people every year that die for not having health care. If you have 20 million people without health care who are marginalized by poor immigration regulations and laws, then we're going to see many of those people dying every year. I don't know what the percentages will work out, but it will be huge.
Okay.
And I think that's unfortunate. But PPACA, I think we're working at the state level to try and ensure that as many people can be included as possible, that we get some cost savings measures built into it. And so I believe in the work that we're doing here. What I wanted to say in closing is that Physicians for National Health Program is starting a campaign of healthcare as a human right. And part of the reason that we're doing that is because we want to see everybody in the nation covered. And we know that this is the really Washington Community Action Network's pledge as well, that they want to see universal healthcare. So we're hoping that by creating alliances with them, that we'll stay in partnership and continue to work towards each other's mutual goals.
Great.
So that's Kathleen Randall with Physicians for a National Health Program, not plan, as I messed up a couple times there. She was talking about the move toward universal health care, why she thinks that should be the goal, along with many. I'm not sure how large their group is, but I've seen a lot of interviews with their members, and it seems to be a pretty powerful group. And it's really exciting to me that Washington Community Action Network is kind of aligned with that goal, as she said at the end. So something else that I meant to mention after the last clip talking about the Affordable Care Act, Dina Knudsen was talking about putting pressure on the insurance commissioner. Who is the insurance commissioner? That's one of those. You may have just got your ballots for the primary. Not very many people vote in the primary. And next week, I'm going to be bringing on a guest, still to be confirmed, to do a voter's guide for the primary. An insurance commissioner is one of those boring races that people don't really pay attention to. There's five dudes on the list, and they have a lot of power in that office, and it's more now with this new law. So we're going to talk about the unsexy offices like insurance commissioner, like school board, the ones that people don't tend to pay as much attention to as, say, governor. So we're going to talk about all of those. What does this person do? Who are your options? What is the outlook? So that's coming next week, is the Praxis Voters Guide. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on Thin Air Community Radio, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, doing a recap, a very, very dense recap of the Washington Community Action Network Summer Leadership Conference last July 14th, not last, but July 14th, 2012, last weekend is what I meant to say. There's so much interesting content here. It was really hard for me to make the cuts that I did to choose stuff. I thought that there was something really interesting at the end. There was a closing panel plenary with three members. And the clip I'm going to play is some different statements from Leanne Baldwin, who's with the Alliance for a Just Society, who is a Washington Community Action National partner. So here's what she said, and I will have a little bit to say about it afterwards.
How we make a difference, not only by voting, but what we do all around the political season that enables us to actually have that result in real change. Because many times, how many people have gone out and voted for someone and been disappointed by the results, not seeing the change they want? How often does that happen? All the time, right? So it makes you kind of want to stay home now and again. I would say the first ingredient not to forget is to continue to build a strong organization like Washington Can is, right? So that means, involved in doing outreach, whether door-to-door, on the phones, emailing, who communicates and spreads that message? That's the foundation of everything we do, and we need to continue to invest in it and not ever forget that. How many people have been part of raising up an issue, making it visible, doing public education, doing an action, holding people accountable? Okay, that's another element of building a strong organization and an ingredient that's necessary to win. Another thing that's really critical is for us to reflect on our vision and our values, even though the world doesn't always reflect them when we look out and around us. Those are my values. Now, you could say them in lots of different ways, but I think if we all drew a picture of the society that we want, most of those pictures on that paper would have a lot of things in common. They would have schools, they would have happy children, they would have fresh vegetables, they would have, clean air, the sun would be shining. That's what we need to articulate as a vision behind what we want. And we need to then move that vision into practicality. The other thing I wanted to note that I think we need to do a better job of on that theme of doing a better job is we need to get out of just urban areas, right? And this speaks to what my friend here was talking about in terms of Republicans. Right now, there's an urban-rural divide in this state, in many states across the country. Not because the conservative agenda is serving rural communities very well, right? Not because those people wouldn't draw the same picture that we draw of what the world would look like if it was better. They want sustainable economies and a clean environment in their communities also. But because we're not out there talking to folks. So where we're not, was unusual, you know, shouldn't be unusual partners, we need to go, whether it's students or rural areas, there are lots of ways that we need to build constituencies and do better. Another key ingredient is being very active in the elections. Again, how many people here are registered folks to vote? How many people have gone door-to-door for a candidate? How many people here have called to get their neighbors out to vote or given a ride on election day, right? We do that together. We do it every year. We do it systematically. That's really another key important ingredient. The problem is that it hasn't been sufficient, right? We're all at times look around at the world and we say, all that hard work and what did it get us? So there are a number of people across the country who have been talking to each other about the need to hold the Democratic Party more to our values and vision, and to begin to get people to identify more publicly within the Democratic Party to a working families agenda, an agenda that believes in those same values that we have, and politicians who are saying, yes, I have the courage when it matters, I'll stand up, I'll speak to those issues, and I'll vote on those issues, and I'll move the agenda forward. We need to build strong national alignment, and it's important both in the inception of this political, the Working Families Party, that it be connected from state to state so that we have that larger context. And that as we elect people not only to the legislature but to the Congress, we can see that alignment grow. We're not talking about a third party. It might be a little confusing because we're calling it the Working Families Party. Actually, it hasn't been named, but there's one in New York State called the Working Families Party. What we're talking about is enabling politicians to stand up and say what they're part of, to define the progressive end of the Democratic Party, and to become so powerful by our contributions working and focusing on that end of the party that we pull everybody toward our values and vision, and so that in the end we create the political leverage necessary to build the strong family, strong community, and strong country we want to see.
So, running out of time, but what I thought was really interesting about what this woman was saying, Leanna Baldwin, she is saying that. I was really on board with everything she was saying. She was saying that we need more communication. We need awareness. We need to talk to everyone in urban and rural areas, get people to see what their common ground is. But then she starts talking about the Democratic Party, the mainstream Democratic Party, and then she talks about this Working Families Party. And I was like, wow, a third party, that sounds like a great topic. And then she comes in to say, this is not a third party. We need to get the Democrats who are aligned with our values to move more in that direction. And it's the best explanation I've heard of why a lot of, quote, progressive people are entrenched with the Democratic Party and supportive of a mainstream Democratic Party that's really just as Wall Street embedded as the Republican Party in a lot of ways, but they're more friendly socially. I guess for me, it just makes more sense to support campaign finance reform and structural reform that can allow for third, fourth, fifth, sixth parties where all of our shared values come out in a variety of ways and are allowed to work together rather than having to work in this really restrictive framework of kind of a false sense of two parties. So I thought it was interesting to hear her describe it that way. I understand that it's kind of it's a strategy, you know, leveraging the power that party already has. Is it effective? Who knows? That's something I'd like to explore a lot more on this show. Along with just the whole concept of what we call ourselves, you know, progressive, conservative, Democrat, Republican, all of those labels I think are really interesting, and the semantics of the whole thing and that idea from earlier with Richard Kirsch of crafting the one narrative. That's something I want to talk about a lot more in the future. So in closing, this was a really interesting experience for me. It was a great experience. I want to thank Washington Community Action Network for putting it on. While the workshop that I played, The Nuts and Bolts of Healthcare Reform, was going, I was in a great workshop put on by John Sellers, who was a founder of the Ruckus Society, and it was on direct action history, imagery, and design. I'm hoping to maybe have him on the show to talk about creative direct action in the future. The other workshops they had, I wish I could have recorded them all. Organizing 101, The War on Women is a Right-Wing Strategy, Fighting Racism Through Grassroots Organizing, Immigrant Rights, A Fight for Family Unity, Caring Across Generations, Direct Action History, like I said, The Voice of Small Business, Corporate Power and Personhood, a ton of topics. One day, I'm really impressed by all the organizers and want to thank them for the hard work they did to put on the Washington Community Action Summer Leadership Conference on July 14th, 2012. Thanks for letting me be there and record it. I know that Jamie Himes from Community Minded Television also recorded a great deal for her new program, Spider Bites, so you can check them out at communityminded.org under Community Minded Television. That's all I've got for you. Thanks for sticking with me. I'm glad I fit that 7 hours of content into 1 hour, and hopefully we'll be able to use more of it in the future. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. This is Praxis, and I'll be back next week with a voter's guide for all of you.